areas in the field of microwave spectroscopy by going to meetings, like the Columbus meeting for the molecular spectroscopy and things of that type. And I met these people, and I worked for Professor Gwynn, and he put me to work building some of the electronic units that were used in the spectrometer that his group was working with. And this was funny because I knew a fair amount about electronics, but I was not a seasoned electronic engineer by any means. And so there were some things I didn't really understand all that well. And one of them was the kind of problems you can get into if you're not careful about keeping everything separated and insulated well enough. And so the unit that I built had a tendency to arc over and do things like that, but it caused them no end of trouble after I left. He used to kid me about it when I would come back and see him. When I'd come up from Caltech and visit, I'd usually go and see Bill Gwynn, and he would kid me about how much trouble he had with that thing that I built. But I learned about what the elements of a microwave spectrometer were, and I was convinced that microwave spectroscopy was the thing I wanted to pursue, because it was clearly a fascinating new form of spectroscopy, and it used purely electronic techniques. There was no optical optics involved, so it's a purely electronic thing. And so I thought, this is my cup of tea. And so I learned about the various ways in which you approach making a good microwave spectrometer, and lots of techniques that they showed me there that I became familiar with. So when I went to Caltech, I knew what I wanted to do, and I just needed to find a professor who would take that under his wing. And it turned out that Don Yost was the absolutely ideal guy for me to work with.
So it didn't take you very long at all to establish that.
I only talked to two or three professors, and as soon as I hit Don Yost, and he said, well, I've got all this surplus microwave gear that, because I'm fascinated by it, and I'd be happy to take you on as a graduate student. And he knew absolutely nothing about microwave spectroscopy. He said, he would be my advisor, but it turned out he knew really nothing about the field, and so he would listen to my problems and, you know, more or less encourage me to figure out how to solve them. And he would absolutely leave me alone completely. If I had never gone into his office, I don't think he would ever come and look for me.
And that didn't worry you?
And it didn't worry me, because I had gotten in the habit of working that way. And I just loved it, that here's nobody is standing over me telling me what to do. I'm responsible for steering the course here. And so that was just the most perfect arrangement. And he, you know, if I went to see him, he would listen to everything I said and would help me in any way he could. He could provide me a little financial support for getting, you know, components and stuff, and provide me with a laboratory, and listen to what problems I had and advise me maybe a little bit on how I might solve them, or what I would need to do to solve them. He was just a wonderful guy, a very droll person, didn't take anything very seriously. He had gotten to the point in life where he realized that really doesn't get you anywhere. And so he was very relaxed about it, and helped to keep me from getting, you know, too intense. And he was just a very nice man, and a friend.
How many graduate students did he have?
He had only a few. He had me. He had John Waugh. We came in together. He had taken on a postdoctoral fellow, Bob Shulman, who has made a huge name for himself. Shulman had done microwave spectroscopy with Townes, And so Shulman, as the postdoctoral fellow, was of enormous help to me, because he knew a lot of things that I hadn't learned in Berkeley, and helped me to build, even to build some equipment. And then after his stint in as a postdoctoral fellow under Yost, and actually Yost sort of said, why don't you help Jim Schuller in microwave spectroscopy, I guess. And he took some courses, and then he went on, and he eventually became a very big name in NMR. And, you know, his grand old father of the application of NMR to biological problems. And he was a very different person than I am. Our personalities are just about as different as they can be. And so that was good, because we kind of pushed each other a little bit. And I was from the school, the Navy School of Building Equipment, where everything has running at right angles and every wire is tied down, you know, beautifully. And Shulman used the technique of building an electronic chassis, which I call the TP method. He had a bunch of wires that were supposed to go somewhere, and they all had a common connection. He pulled them all together and twisted them together and put some solder on it. So to me, his construction was really sloppy. But the thing is, all of his stuff worked. It never failed. We had no problems with any of it, and the stuff that I had built so carefully up in Berkeley was failing right and left. So it was a sort of a humbling experience. It was a very, very good relationship, though, with Bob, because he helped me a great deal, and we got the equipment running in much shorter time than if I had to figure this all out myself.
Are you saying you were into sort of building equipment and defining a research project almost from day one?
Yeah,
when you were down
basically
there?
The first thing was build a microwave spectroscopy, a spectrometer, and that required assembling all the rest of the equipment you could buy, and what you couldn't buy you built. And that took me a couple of years to get this thing working to the point where it would produce microwave spectra of molecules. And of course, microwave spectra have to be done at a very low pressure, mm-hmm. in order to get away from the effect of collisions between the atoms, because you're talking about the pre-rotation of molecules, and it can't be getting disrupted by mm-hmm. collisions all the time. So you work at 10 to the minus 6 or lower millimeters of mercury, almost a vacuum. And it sounded great to people that, gee, you're using micrograms of stuff. This must be just the world's most wonderful analytical technique. What people forgot is that as soon as a molecule has more than about 6 atoms in it, the vapor pressure of it won't be more than micrograms of mm-hmm. stuff. And as soon as it's no longer a symmetric molecule, as soon as it becomes an asymmetric rotor, its spectrum becomes so complicated that you almost can't sort it out. Mm-hmm. And so I learned all about those things in the process of building this thing. And as a result, when Hewlett-Packard Company went into commercial production of a microwave spectrometer, I didn't worry about them being any competition at all for Marion, because I knew that microwave spectroscopy just had no future as an analytical tool. Mm-hmm. At Varian, there was never very much desire to go into it, but people would sometimes bring it up, and I could always tell them, well, here are the problems. And I think that this is a good place to put our research money, as long as we've got something as good as NMR to put it into. So, actually, working in microwave spectroscopy was very good in teaching me how to build equipment and how to find a problem and how to apply the equipment to a problem. Then I finally worked on a molecule, HNCO. That's forgotten what we call it. Cyanic acid. Cyanic acid, the HOCN, but this is HNCO, and the hydrogen's on the nitrogen. And it turns out that it's a linear molecule, except that the hydrogen is cocked off to a slight angle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, turns out it's what's called a symmetric rotor, and its spectrum is not as bad as an asymmetric molecule. And I was able to measure enough frequencies of various lines and assign them that I could then calculate all the moments of inertia, and from that I could calculate the structure. So that was my thesis, the structure of isocyanic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's just all it is an exercise in building equipment, finding a problem, solving the problem, and defending the solution.
And that actually kind of fitted pretty neatly inside 4 years of activity, as it were.
Yeah, actually, I think it was 3 years. I actually completed my work in 3 years, but then I got mononucleosis, and I was sick for about a month, really sick, in the sick bay there at Caltech. Then I went home to recuperate for a couple of months because it was clear I wasn't going to get my thesis done by the time that was needed. So then I didn't graduate, but I had completed all the work. I had passed my final orals, so it was only a matter of submitting the thesis. And so they took Don Yost took me on as a postdoctoral fellow. And then the following year, I quit in the middle line. That's a terrible thing to do. But Don Yost was the kind of guy that you could do that with because he didn't care that much. He was disappointed, but he also saw that I had a clear idea of what I needed to do and that I was. It was a great opportunity, and so he didn't oppose it. And the work that I did for him was fascinating also. I worked on a different approach to the problem of carbon-14 dating of artifacts, wood artifacts. He had a scheme in mind that he thought would improve the accuracy of C-14 dating. And this was based on being able to get a more sensitive indication of the number of radioactive decays from a given sample of carbon. The way most people were doing it was to burn the carbon, make it into carbon dioxide, purify it, and then convert it to some stable compound containing the carbon and then count it with a regular counter, a Geiger counter.
Mm-hmm.
His idea was to convert it to CO2 and put it under pressure in a steel tank about this big around and about that long, which would contain the pressure. We put it about 150 pounds pressure, about 10 atmospheres in there. In the middle of this chamber was an electrometer, an insulated post with a flap of gold leaf on it that would take a charge and the thing would come out at an mm-hmm. angle. You could look through a window and see the angle of this thing and see the decay of the decay rate of the radioactivity caused by the radioactivity ionizing the gas, mm-hmm. which would then partially discharge the electrometer. This had a lot more sensitivity than the Geiger counter. It was the cumulative effect.
Right.
But the problems were pretty severe, and that first was that there are alpha particles on the surface of everything. You had to get rid of the effect of the stray radioactivity from the walls of the counter. And this is after you had figured out how to burn the carbon and purify the CO2 and then pump it into this thing. So what we did is we built a grid of wires that were near the outer surface of the thing, and they screened it from any of the alpha particle ions. Mm-hmm. They picked them up, because the alpha particles have short ranges and they ionize everything out close to the walls, but they didn't get attracted inside this grid. They were picked up by the grid. So then the only decays inside the grid were caused by either alpha particles contaminating the grid,
mm-hmm.
or the gold leaf, or decay of carbon 14.
Mm-hmm.
So we got pretty good. We got that pretty well in control. But then we discovered that cosmic rays were generating a lot of background, and the only way to get around away from cosmic rays is to go underground. Mm-hmm. So twice a week I would get in my car and drive about 30 miles out east of Pasadena to a canyon where there was a dam, and I could go under the dam and down into this place way under you know, 200 feet of cement, and then we had a little lead house built with lead bricks because there was natural radioactivity in the cement,
mm-hmm.
Gamma ray activity. And so eventually I would take this thing out there and charge it up and put it in its little house, and then I'd come back 3-4 days later and take a reading, and I could, from that, calculate the amount of radioactivity in that C14, in that particular number of grams of C14, and work back to the age of the sample. And we could, this, it looked like the basic sensitivity could be pushed out to about 50,000 years. You would have a reasonable accuracy at 50,000 years, whereas the Geiger counter was pretty well gone, like at around 10,000 years, 10 to 15,000 years. But eventually all of this went for nothing because they figured out how to do coincidence counting, and they used a whole bunch of counters and took coincidences, and with that they get comparable results with a lot easier
mm-hmm.
experiment. So this never went anywhere, but I stopped in the middle. Probably was a good time to stop because they were just about ready to bring in this new coincidence counting. So when I decided that I wanted to go into NMR and that I wanted to do it at Varian in the middle of my year, I told Professor Yost, and he released me from the commitment to the postdoctoral fellowship.
You were really learning something about the practical problems of implementing some theoretical idea.
And it turned out later that there were many practical problems in turning an NMR experiment into a useful instrument. And I had a lot of experience with that. So that didn't floor me, you know. When I ran into those things, it didn't discourage me.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back in Caltech, if we may. And you did take significant further coursework there.
Oh yes, a lot of coursework. Mm. Oh yes, I took. I took a statistical mechanics course from a professor named Kirkwood, who was really the leading statistical mechanician in the country. He was a terrific guy. He, unfortunately, was not a good teacher in the sense that he was not very conscious of whether it was getting through to you or not. He simply got up and he put it up there on the board. And then his examinations consisted of you basically reproducing it. So that wasn't very inspiring to me. And furthermore, I didn't think well in mathematical terms. I'm not basically a very good mathematician. And so that was a hard course for me. I had to work very hard at it, and I certainly knew I didn't want to do that for a living. But one of my best friends, his name is Bernie Alder, and he went on to work at UC Berkeley for a long time on the theory of liquids. Bernie Alder. And he worked on the theory of liquids, and then he went to work for Livermore Laboratories on some of the problems of fluids that are connected with the motions of particles in nuclear events, you know, nuclear bombs. And so he and I have stayed in touch also because we were roommates for a while at Caltech, and he was the exact opposite. He absolutely ate up statistical mechanics. It's just everything. He thinks of the world in terms of statistical mechanics. and he made his career there, and I got out of there as quickly as possible and focused on other things. I had to take, not an awful lot of coursework. I'm trying to remember what other courses I had. I took some courses in physics involving, I had one course from Feynman, which I believe I got about halfway through that one and decided that I can't follow this man. He was too far ahead of me, and also had a tendency to, you know, to assume that you were following him instead of watching it, how you were doing. But he was a very interesting man, and I absolutely enjoyed just the experience of knowing him and how he functioned. But his ideas were way beyond what I had the capacity to really do anything about, so I didn't finish that course.
What about Linus Pauling?
I didn't have any courses from Pauling. I sat in on some of his lectures in the undergraduate courses just because he was such a good lecturer, and I wanted to get the feel of him. And he was a very stimulating speaker, and I just certainly don't regret any of the time I spent listening to him lecturing. I don't think I had an awful lot of coursework, though. I had most of the requirements already. I may be just forgetting something there.
Was there much social life, as it were? Where did it, with other, you know, just other graduate students, faculty, the department as such?
Graduate students do tend to band together for protection, you know, just to have some human contact and somebody who understands what they're going through. And it is a very monastic kind of situation. And so, you know, you do need to take some time off, and it's nice to have somebody to do it with. So the first year graduate students tend to form little groups of friends, friendship groups. And so you have some people that you can, you know, if it's Friday night and you decided you need to go to a movie or something, there's somebody to go with. Some people were more skilled at making connections with women, but there weren't any women at Caltech, of course, in those years. And so you had to go fishing at Occidental or Claremont colleges, and that required a little bit more confidence than I had. Later on in the second and third year, I actually did meet some women skating and maybe at a couple of dances or something, and I did some dating, and I almost lured one young woman off the track that she should have been on. She had a boyfriend, and I enjoyed her company, and I started to kind of come on to her pretty strong, and it really gave her a terrible conflict. And I realized finally that this is what I was doing, and so I kind of pulled back, and I didn't really want to break up something that was important to her. But I was attracted to her, and it was good practice, actually, and I did learn that if I really put myself forward, I can make the kind of impression that I want to make. And that really helped a lot, that I was able to do that with her, and yet at the same time I didn't feel it would be ethical to move ahead I wasn't in any position, you know, to do anything more seriously at that time. And I thought it would not be ethical to keep upsetting her and giving her choices, you know, something to compare when she feels pretty committed where she is. So I just found that was a very good experience for me, but it didn't really go anywhere. And it's probably, I'm pretty sure it was definitely for the best.
Well, you were living in, where were you living?
I lived several places. I lived in a private home, just renting a room the first year. That was kind of hard. It was not easy for anybody, but it worked. Then the second year, I think I lived in housing, student housing. They had some graduate student housing, and a room came available. And my roommate was Alan Sandage, the astronomer who has been involved in determining the age of the universe. Mm-hmm. I think he's at Harvard, and he's considered, you know, one of the experts on the cosmology. And it was very fascinating because in those days he and I were rather similar in temperament. We tended to be very serious. We'd worry a lot about how well we were doing. But Alan Sandage was one step ahead of me as a worrier. He really didn't have his self-confidence built up yet. Now, once he became famous, once he demonstrated to himself that he was, you know, better than any of the other people around, he's fine. But while he was a student, he used to lie there trying to go to sleep at night and agonizing over whether or not he would even graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't always show on people. They can be enormously talented and productive and still feel like they're on the verge of failure. Mm-hmm. But he got through that and, you know, became a famous man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a interesting thing, insight into how people were, to have spent a year rooming with him. Then one other year, the third year, I think, I roomed with my friend Bernie Alder. We took we rented an apartment somewhere, mm-hmm. and we shared it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the housing there.
Mm-hmm. Your time overlapped a little bit with Gordon Moore.
I had no contact with anybody outside of chemistry. Caltech is very compartmentalized.
He was in chemistry.
Oh, he was.
But a couple of years
behind. No, it must have been at a different time, because I would have certainly known of his presence there.
Yeah.
Or he was in such a different branch of chemistry, maybe, that we didn't, our paths didn't cross.
He was in Badger's group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was spectroscopy.
Yeah.
And Badger was a spectroscopist.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As you're getting towards graduation, PhD graduation, what are you thinking about what you're going to do when you grow up?
I mean, I was sort of, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it in person. Mm-hmm. My main focus was to get the job done, get the degree. There's something about the way they work this thing where the fact that you have to pass your final orals keeps you very focused, because you don't know what you're going to encounter there, whether you're going to run into somebody who's going to give you a hard time. They have the power to force you into another year of work. Some professors, in fact, even use this as a way of keeping slave labor going, although that's kind of an unethical thing to do, but they do it. Some of them do. Don Yost would not have done that. I wasn't worried about that. But you always worry about, will I get past this examination? Because any question can be asked, and it's more how you answer it than it is whether you get the right answer. And so you don't know in what field they're going to pick, so you just have to be a generalist and study everything. You put in an enormous amount of time studying. Eventually you have to say, okay, if I don't know it now, I never will, and I do know more than I think I do, so it's time to go find out. But I didn't think too much beyond that, because I thought this is enough to be thinking about right now.
But chemistry, electronics, instrumentation, I mean, you're pretty happy in that grazing zone.
Yes, and I forgot to mention that I did take off from Caltech during the summer of 1950, I believe, and I went to GE, Schenectady Laboratories, because there was a guy there doing microwave spectroscopy, and I wanted to see how does microwave spectroscopy go over in an industrial laboratory. I'm going to have to take a little break because of the coffee. If we go-